Good morning. The move to increase the cigarette excise tax comes up before the State House Health Committee this morning. First, we'll hear from the president of the Tax Foundation of Hawaii. And kids in sports may be wholesome fun or potentially dangerous, which is why some would like to expand the concussion education program for middle and high school students. The lead researcher for the state's baseline data joins us today. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Dr. Ruth Gates finds both cause for concern and reasons to hope in the condition of the world's corals. And Ambassador of Aloha Danny Kalikini keeps a family tradition alive in a new musical collaboration with his grandson Nicholas. Both will be in our studio this morning.
It's Wednesday, March 23rd. The conversation starts right after this news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Hello there, Chris.
Good morning, Beth Ann. We're looking at least one of the taxes on sin, yeah?
Right, and the question is it appropriate? We're going to talk about that this morning. Now, you've probably heard someone say that if you want to stop people from buying a certain product, well, just heavily tax it. That link between taxation and how to influence behavior is apparent in a measure still on the move this session. It would increase the cigarette and small cigar tax. This morning, the House Health Committee will consider Senate Bill 2690's latest draft, which ditched the actual amount of the tax and the allocation of revenue, also the effective date, to facilitate further discussion. That's the line that frequently shows up to focus on the intent and not necessarily on the specifics of a bill. And the intent of this bill is at the heart of comments made by the Tax Foundation of Hawaii. Its president, Tom Yamachika, joins us now. Good morning.
Morning, Beth Ann.
So as you look at this bill, and obviously you've made comments about it, the central question is what are lawmakers trying to do with this bill?
Yeah, now there's a couple of things going on, obviously. One is there's some sentiment in the Department of Health that they want to disincentivize this behavior, namely smoking, and they'll do whatever it takes. Their efforts have been largely successful because the sales of cigarettes have, in fact, been dropping.
We've also raised the legal age of smoking from 18 to 21.
Right. That was a big step that happened last year. But apparently they want to do more.
The idea of being able to create a funding mechanism, a revenue stream for programs to stop people from smoking or to be able to prevent it with educational outreach, that all seems to be understandable and logical. But the question about this bill is, in fact, is that going to create a revenue stream that's dependable?
Well, the problem in the past with having programs or services depend on a sin tax like this one is that when behavior does start to change, and people do come to Jesus or whatever, and the sin goes down, so does the money, and the programs and services that have been relying on that money are now in trouble. And certainly that's been the case with the School of Medicine and the UH Cancer Center. Both of these, fine institutions are funded by funds that derive their revenue from the tobacco tax. And as I mentioned, the amount of tobacco sales have been going down. The fund has been drying up. And the Cancer Center and the School of Medicine have been relying on those funds, and now they're in trouble because the money's drying up.
So is this really just meant to be a stopgap measure, and the idea being that okay, if sales start to drop and people's behavior is changing, then maybe we don't need as many programs too.
Well, that's quite possible, but it doesn't seem to be the intent of this bill. Now, the other, I guess, justification for doing this bill, which is in one prior incarnation, was a 25% increase in the per stick tax. Now, the cigarette tax now is 16 cents a stick, which is one of the highest in the nation, and the previous draft of the bill would raise it to 20 cents. Okay. So, and you know, some of the supporters of the bill are saying, well, geez, we haven't had a tobacco tax increase for 5 years. But that doesn't mean that nothing happened. I mean, come on. The smoking age went up last year, which is a huge step in the effort to stop or disincentivize the behavior. Now, if what they're doing is if their goal is to stop the behavior, then you can do a couple of things. You can tax it, or you can ban it. And raising the smoking age is a way of banning it, at least for, you know, part of the population.
The way in which this is crafted, though, also brings up the idea of black market value and what might happen should the value of this increase because people can't get it till a certain age and it's highly taxed.
Right. So that's another very good point, Beth Ann, and that is, what kind of behavior are you incentivizing? Yeah, people may start smoking the product. I mean, stop smoking, which is what you want to do, or what you want to incentivize. At least these people do. Or you will create greater incentives for people to go elsewhere, like the black market, and that's and you see that very frequently in some of the other states where this has happened, especially when you have. Adjacent states with like less in terms of tobacco tax or cross border. Here, it's kind of tougher to have black market smuggling because you know we have a lot of water between us and anywhere else. But it's still possible. It happens.
So as you look at where we are with this bill now, and it seems like it's got great steam behind it, and there are a lot of people who believe that this is the way to go. What are the unintended consequences that perhaps we haven't talked about that we should?
Well,
besides the idea that we might create an incentive for different kinds of behavior, including black market activity.
Again, one possible consequence is you may be a victim of your own success. If you jack up the price of cigarettes yet again, demand may go down some more. And other programs, services, or whatnot that are depending on this revenue, they're going to suffer some more. They're probably budgeting on or banking on an increase or at least the stable funding, and that's not going to happen.
Is there something that you see that would be a better way to achieve the same ends as the intent of this bill?
Well, it's difficult to figure out what the intent of this bill is. Is it to raise money? Is it to change behavior? If it's to change behavior, then why don't you just ban it?
Which brings us right back to the beginning of the conversation. What is this really meant to do? Thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you, Bethan.
Tom Yamachiga is the president of the Tax Foundation of Hawaii, SB 2690, which increases the excise tax on cigarettes and little cigars. It is scheduled to be heard by the Health Committee in the House, Conference Room 329.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:13. Coming up, the director of the University of Hawaii's Institute of Marine Biology looks at the condition of coral reefs around the world. But first, your quiz.
Unihoa. kaua o ahu o molokai o lanai o mau o ka ho'olawe o Hawaii.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about a television show set in Hawaii that ran for just a single season in 1993 and 94. Its executive producer, Stephen Bochco, was an established source of hit TV shows, and there were high hopes for this one. It was the story of a family who had relocated to Hawaii with a was notable in its efforts to tell stories that reflected local culture. It was an hour-long drama about a father and his three children who came to Hawaii from New Haven after the sudden death of the children's mother. The father becomes a headmaster of a local private school where his children attend. Family members interact with several local characters played by local actors, and storylines took on such subjects as teenage pregnancy and underage drinking. It aired 12 times on ABC, and a 13th episode that featured a pigeon production of Shakespeare was filmed but never aired. This morning we're looking for the name of this underrated show, and we'll be back with it in about a half an hour. If you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and the first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, a private school for girls in grades preschool through high school, where the focus is on science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Learn more at sacredhearts.org.
Worldwide concern is growing over the continuing decline of coral reefs, even as our understanding grows of their essential role in marine ecosystems. It's a bleak picture, but Dr. Ruth Gates, director of the University of Hawaii's Institute of Marine Biology, sees signs of hopes. She looks at some especially resilient corals and says there are ways their resilience can become a resource for others. She's giving a talk on the subject as part of the Waikiki Aquarium's Distinguished Lecture Series, and she's on the line with us this morning. Good morning, Dr. Gates.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Pretty good. It's good to hear something positive on this front, isn't it?
It absolutely is, and I think that, you know, it's a little bit overwhelming when you think of all of the reports of coral death. I think that, you know, what we're trying to do really is to think about the more hopeful signs, and that is that some corals and some reefs are doing much better than we might expect.
Even as they face the same conditions that those that aren't doing well face?
That's exactly right, Chris. I mean, I think that this is the wonderful thing about biology. There's a huge amount of variation in the way that individual species even respond. You know, you can see that in humans. Some humans are extremely good athletes,
sure,
and some aren't. Some are very, good at combating disease, and some aren't.
Mm-hmm.
And the same is true for corals.
So you find the especially resilient corals and kind of figure out what they've got that the rest don't have, yeah?
That's exactly right. We're trying to understand the biology that underpins that greater ability to withstand conditions that kill other corals.
Well, what are the things that you would examine in a case like that?
So corals are really, like all organisms, they have sort of variety in their basic genetics. So how and who their parents were is important. So if their parents are particularly resilient individuals in the population, then the offspring will do well. But corals are really the sort of consortium organism of the planet. They are dependent on tiny little plant cells that live inside their tissues. And it's these cells that actually give the corals their color, that characteristic brown color. And we know that if the coral partners with a particular type of plant cell, that it might be able to withstand stress better than an alternative partnership. So who you partner with is critically important if you're a coral.
Well, it makes sense in terms of things that we're learning a lot about humans, which is that we're not one organism. We're host to hundreds, right, of various bacteria.
Absolutely.
And so lots of little Santa's helpers running around inside us. Similar in the case of an organism like coral, you're saying?
Absolutely. In fact, you know, the corals are masters of using the biology of others. And you know, they associate with lots of bacteria. But they are amazing in that they've been able to develop these really close interactions with you know, organisms that function like all plants do, to actually photosynthesize, fix inorganic carbon dioxide into a food supply. And the coral is actually fed by its plant from within. So essentially, corals have...
I think we might have just lost you, Dr. Gates. Dr. Gates, do we have you back on the line?
We do. I'm so sorry about
you that. You scared me for
lots
a minute
technology.
There. That's quite all right. Well, it just shows how vulnerable we still are, doesn't it?
We are. So I was just saying, you know, they're kicking out these plant cells because the plant cells are no longer able to function properly in these high temperatures. And so the animal suddenly sees them, and rather than being a benefit of being a food source, they now see them as a foreign body that they need to get rid of.
Huh.
And kick them out. And so the coral pales as it loses those cells. It's fascinating. This
now, what's that in
relationship?
What's that in response to when you say the coral pales and expels these? What is that?
Coral bleaching is actually, it's most often associated with higher than normal temperatures. And so, you know, as we move through and climate change intensifies, the reefs globally are actually closer to their temperature limits, and any intermittent spike now can cause a bleaching event. And we've seen that here in Hawaii 2 years in a row. We had a bleaching event in Hawaii in 2014,
mm-hmm.
and another one in 2015. And both of those events were associated with higher than normal seawater temperatures.
That's a particularly difficult problem to address, isn't it?
It really is. I mean, it's a global problem. I mean, obviously, the way to address it is to really stop fossil fuel burning. That's going to reduce the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, and it's going to start to halt the warming of the planet.
Fossil fuel
as
burning.
Well as the acidification of the water.
Has that is it already too late? I mean, in terms of fossil fuel burning, which isn't likely to stop tomorrow, have we passed a kind of a critical point with that?
So I think my sense is that you know, the jury is out as to whether we will stop it. I think that everybody is pushing to stop it. But I think we've now moved to this point where we have to think about adapting to this new normal, if mm-hmm. you will. And that's what a lot of our work is really under the umbrella of climate change adaptation, proactive strategies to try and offset the impacts, to address and accommodate the fact that our planet has changed, and attempt to develop corals and coral stocks that are actually provisioned to face the conditions of the future.
So coral that can deal with heightened ocean temperatures.
Exactly.
And sort of finding out which those are and what conditions allow them to thrive, yeah?
Yes, and how we breed them and how we grow them and how we could use them if we were to move to thinking about restoring reefs that are already damaged or building resilience on reefs that are somewhat damaged. So it is really a sort of a taking 25 years of basic science that we've now got a really good idea of what's underpinning the differences in the sensitivity of corals to temperature,
mm-hmm.
and now harnessing that into an action-oriented solution.
And you say breeding them. Now you're talking about the kind of strategy that's employed with other endangered species, where you take them out of the wild and allow them to flourish in ideal conditions, but in essentially lab conditions.
Yes, I mean, our goal would be to try to breed them and get the biology back onto the reef. I mean, really, at the end of the day, when we think about what reefs do, they're critical to creating habitat for fish and other organisms that we eat, so the food supply. They are critical in protecting the land behind them, and they serve as a platform for tourism. And so what the goal would be to understand and develop these corals and then think about how we might move them back into the reef and perpetuate our reefs. I mean, that really is what we need to do. We need to continue to have coral reefs. In my opinion, the end point of having essentially large aquaria that showcase the last of the corals on the planet is not what we're about.
No, we want them in the ocean where they belong.
Exactly, and it's better to intervene early than it is to wait until they are threatened and endangered species.
I don't think you'll find too much disagreement there. Dr. Gates, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Chris. It was wonderful to be here.
My pleasure. Dr. Ruth Gates is the director of and a researcher at the University of Hawaii's Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. She'll be speaking on the wonderful world of corals, harnessing basic science to address an ecological crisis. That's Thursday, April 7th at 6:30 at the Thurston Memorial Chapel in Honolulu. It's part of the Waikiki Aquarium's Distinguished Lecture Series.
Vamos para longe do mar azul. E não importa se vamos pro norte ou se vamos pro sul. A nossa viagem, isso é cool. Próxima parada é a bela ilha de Malibu.
The Fields of Flanders, a battlefield in a new war.
Europe are suffering the same pain that this region has known every single day.
Belgium's challenge in maintaining security in concentrated neighborhoods means ISIS can apparently operate freely throughout Europe. Has the sleeper cell awakened? Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
It could be said that what we have here is a failure to communicate. It could also be said that Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell's relationship with the city council couldn't get any worse, or could it? Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair asked that question in today's Reality Check. Good morning. We've heard from council members that they feel that in many cases the mayor just completely circumvents them, that they get cut out of the information loop. They have to find out about policy and you know, other programs that might be in the media but not necessarily told to them directly. Could this relationship deteriorate any more?
Well, that's the basic point of Anita Hofschneider's article. Now, disagreements between a council and a mayor are nothing new. That is part of the process. But it seems like it's particularly deteriorated to a lower level than we've seen before. Let me give you an example. Just last week, at a public hearing, several council members actually called the mayor insincere and disrespectful. Why? Well, that's because the mayor had a press conference the day before the council was going to veto that recycling subsidy bill. Remember that one?
Mm-hmm.
He did not tell the council about this. He proposed a compromise. And, of course, the very next day, the council went ahead and overrode the veto. The point here is that the council members say, look, you should reach out and tell us that you're going to do this. Send an amendment to the council so that we can consider that. Instead of the traditional courtesy that is normally expected between the two branches, there's a feeling that there's a level of disrespect there. And we've heard that from several council members.
Is there a way back when you talk to the council members who've said that he's disrespectful, that they're really waiting for the mayor to change his behavior to begin to at least to extend some olive branches?
Well, remember, this is an election year, and several people suggested that they wonder whether this has more to do with Ernie Martin versus Kirk Caldwell. Now, Ernie, the council chair, Ernie Martin, has not officially declared that he's running, but one wonders whether that might be fueling some of the tension, because among the issues that have been most difficult to reach compromise on are dealing with homelessness and affordable housing. And, of course, those are very big issues right now. Trevor Ozawa, a council member, even went so far as to suggest that maybe we need to have a liaison position, someone who can work between the council and the mayor, even though the mayor has several people on his communication staff. I should add, by the way, the mayor's office turned down a request to interview the mayor for his side of the story.
We talked to him last week, and he said, well, you know, pretty much what we talked about a little earlier, that, well, you know, there's inherent problems between councils and mayors, et cetera, but seemed to paper over a lot of the issues that, we've just been talking about. But to go so far as to say we need, you know, one more layer of, someone who can run interference?
It's very unlikely that that's going to happen. But let me give you another example. Martin, the council chair, held a press conference of his own in which he had a box of Kleenex on his desk. And it pretty much suggested that here's my reaction to any complaints from the, mayor, you know, crocodile tears, if you will. So clearly this has gone to a new level where it's playing out on the airwaves. I wouldn't say that the mayor can paper this over. These are serious issues. And again, though, let's clarify. It is an election year, and all sorts of things are at stake. And homelessness and affordable housing are very much going to be on the minds of voters.
You bet. They're not going away. But we have to for the moment, so I'll talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks, Bethann.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat.
At 8:30, you're tuned to The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Chris Vandercook. If you want to be in touch, you can reach us on our talkback line, 808-792-8217. On Twitter, we're at HI Conversation or at BKOZHPR. And you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Coming up, a grandfather-grandson musical collaboration. But first, the news from the BBC.
Support for The Conversation comes from Diamond Entertainment, presenting Taimane's Hawaii Theater debut, The Elements, a musical and theatrical odyssey, this Friday at 8 p.m. Information and tickets at hawaiitheater.com.
And tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. And Bert, we're... It's kind of at the point where we can see the impact of those STEM programs in schools, yeah?
Well, so we've been covering STEM for quite a while, you know, STEM being science, technology, engineering, and math. And, you know, the schools have a lot of programs where the kids get involved with stuff like robotics and science Olympiad and science fairs. And I think as a whole, I think the, you know, the state's education department has embraced, you know, getting students really kind of geared up for sort of perhaps a career in science or perhaps at least a study pathway. And then what we haven't really explored is, you know, on the workforce development side, on the folks that actually are involved with kind of helping to steer kids in the right direction, especially as it pertains to job opportunities in Hawaii.
Exactly.
I'm kind of curious, what are the thoughts on their part in terms of, you know, are we kind of synced up in terms of getting the right kinds of graduates and filling the right kinds of positions, and are the companies in Hawaii really producing the kinds of opportunities that our kids should be, you know, getting employed in?
Yeah, Bert, I find myself sounding like a parent. It's like, that's nice, but can you get a job doing it, right?
Yeah, so, you know, where are we in terms of making this whole STEM ecosystem work, especially when we're looking at trying to up the level of our, you know, our not only our kids' capabilities of getting employed, but attracting some of the graduates that have left Hawaii and gotten their engineering or science degrees on the mainland? I mean, do we have opportunity for them to come back to?
Yeah, let's stop that brain drain, right?
yeah. So we'll explore that, see what some of the folks have to say about that.
Sounds great, Bert. Thanks a lot.
Sure
that,
thing.
That is Bite Marks Cafe tonight at 5 p.m.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the state of Hawaii, offering Hawaii tax-exempt bonds to individual investors on March 30th. More information, including the preliminary official statement for bonds, is available from a registered broker.
Interscholastic sports and youth sports leagues are often touted as character builders. Of late, concern over the concussion potential and later trauma influenced behavior of contact sports, including football and hockey, has made some parents think twice about allowing their kids to participate. Locally, calls for better training have found root in a measure to expand the youth concussion education program for middle and high school students. With money appropriated to the UH Department of Kinesiology and Rehabilitation Science, Nathan Murata is the chair of that department, and he's on the phone with us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann. How are you?
I'm doing all right, thanks, and thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
We've had a lot of focus on this. I mean, even just this month, the Pop Warner, the nation's largest youth program, football program, settled its very first lawsuit over a concussion. And a lot of parents are greatly concerned that, you know, something that was once regarded as good, clean fun, perhaps, is really seriously risky. Is what we're seeing with this measure that's going to be heard in about 10 minutes, is this more geared toward protecting liability or really trying to educate more parents and students about potential risk?
Well, I think the concussion law that was instituted back in 2012 by the state of Hawaii has certainly provided much more awareness of the potential effects of a concussion, particularly in sports here in the state of Hawaii. And I think right now it's more of a issue of, you know, it's I wouldn't say it's it could be a liability issue, but I'm more interested in seeing it become more of a part of the culture of how we do training, how we educate our people as to the importance of recognizing the signs and symptoms of a particular concussion, and not to take away from any of the great type of physical activity that's been going on in our state.
So do we need this bill to be able to train better?
Well, I think we'd like to get the bill passed primarily to continue to work with and educate our students, particularly at the high schools where we started for the past 5 to 6 years, where we've provided the schools with the tools to do cognitive baseline testing prior to the start of their season. And if they do get a concussion, then they go back on this particular cognitive system to do a post-test, and then a neuropsych then gauges the pre-post-test type of data to determine whether or not the student is able to return to play or return to the return-to-play protocol that we have established for the Hawaii high schools.
That said, why doesn't the Department of Health like this bill?
Oh, I think the Department of Health has been very supportive of what we've been doing, particularly with the area of concussions. I think part of the issue with this particular bill, we've been doing it with the high schools for many years, and we're slowly trying to educate the middle schools and the community organizations, and we've done so through HCAMP and through the department. We've gone out to various areas throughout the state of Hawaii to educate parents, youth coaches, volunteer people, even child care providers, to on the extent of concussions and recognizing signs and symptoms. I think it's more of a feasibility issue with respect to what the Department of Health is concerned with. How are we, a group of two or three individuals, really able to determine, get to all the youth-type programs to provide the kinds of services that we're doing for the high school kids? I think that is the feasibility issue is the one that we're very concerned with.
And isn't there also an issue that it would be siphoning off more money from the Neurotrauma Special Fund?
No, I think the Neurotrauma Special Fund was instituted for us, provided to us way back in the day. But that particular fund was made, provided to us with a clear understanding from day one that this was not something that would be something that they could sustain. It was sort of a seed startup type of fund to get us going. So we knew from the very beginning, back in 2010, quite frankly, that eventually funding from the Neurotrauma Special Fund will end. And therefore, we are in the process of looking at different options to continue the generous funding that the Department of Health, particularly the Neurotrauma Support Fund, has given to the department and to HCAMP.
So what are you looking at as a funding stream now?
Well, I think that's why we're having the House look at our legislative bill, the legislative bill to continue to assist with the to assist schools to help them to pay for the cognitive type testing that we've been doing for the past 5 to 6 years.
At this point, where obviously a lot of parents are deeply concerned that their mm-hmm. children might be at risk.
Yes.
And given the fact that this bill may or may not pass, mm-hmm. and money is one of the big issues, as well as feasibility. You mentioned just a few people who would
yes.
be responsible for doing this.
Mm-hmm.
What more should be placed on families and schools and other organizations that deal with kids and sports?
Well, I think number one is there's a lot of information now out on, and it's not only from us, but across the country, that talks about and explains clearly what the signs and symptoms of a concussion looks like and gives dangerous signs. And it gives people an opportunity to say, look at these signs and symptoms and what to do when you recognize this. I think it's the education piece for a lot of the parents. We certainly don't want to take away from the benefits of extracurricular activities, including sports. And we certainly don't want to put a fear factor in anyone's idea or mind that this is not a good thing. We are very advocates of continued participation. But I also think the education and the awareness piece also has to be interwoven into this whole process so that parents have a good idea that their child will be safe in participating. And sports organizations are clearly moving towards becoming more safe in their approach to practices, to contact, to various modes of, to minimize the amount of concussions that a student athlete can possess or obtain.
Nathan Murata, as you look at kids of all ages, and
yes.
this bill is focusing on middle and high school students,
yes.
is there an age you think that kids are just too young to be engaging in contact sports?
Well, there's literature out there that suggests that, at a certain age, there shouldn't be any kind of contact. I know some states have said there should be no contact until the child is probably like in the ninth grade. So each state has different varying degrees of laws or implementation, if you will. I'm not an expert in when a student or a child should participate. I think it's strictly a parent and family choice to participate. And even when you're riding skateboards, you're riding your bike, you can also have a tendency, kids sometimes may fall and God forbid, injure themselves that may cause some kind of concussion. And so there's different things that can occur or the scenarios of a concussion and how it can play into it. With the young kids, playing, falling off the jungle gym, falling out of a tree, just your common types of activities that a lot of kids engage in potentially can result into a concussion if they fall and hit their head inappropriately. And I think, too, it's the fact that if the parents and people around the child, if they're educated and well aware of the potential and the signs and symptoms, then they can act and react accordingly.
It's a little different, though, when your child is maybe playing on the jungle gym or doing something of that nature, riding a bike or a skateboard, and you're dealing with your own child,
yes.
and safety precautions, and also then trying to leverage that into understanding of what happens when you're on a team sport,
mm-hmm.
and you've got a lot of emotions flaring, and that's a whole different idea when it comes to a potential traumatic brain injury.
Yes.
So at this point, are you also saying that maybe we need not just to know how to recognize the signs and symptoms of concussion, but also to look at, how we coach and how parents, sort of incite their kids to do better?
Yeah, I think it goes hand in hand, not only the education and awareness, but also, again, for organizations to take a self-reflection and to look internally as to how they're doing. I know you mentioned the Pop Warner lawsuit, but I also know that Pop Warner has changed drastically their practices and their coaching techniques, and I think a lot of the other programs, community organizations, have taken a serious look at how much contact, how much physical contact should be allotted for children, and so I think organizations, including mm-hmm. including our high schools, are seriously looking at. And the coaches are taking every precaution to minimize the kinds of contact to so that we can significantly reduce the amount of injuries that may occur.
Nathan Murata, we need to go. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, hello, Beth Ann. Take care.
Nathan Murata is the chair of the UH Manoa Department of Kinesiology and Rehabilitation Science.
Hi, good morning. I'm Kurt Sui from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show at hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we thought about a network TV series filmed in Hawaii that aired in the 1993-94 season. It ran on ABC and told the story of a mainland family that relocated to Hawaii after the death of the mother. One of the characters was a psychiatrist who held his sessions on the beach, helping the children cope with her loss. Local actors found work as local characters whose lives became intertwined with those of the show's main characters, and one show that never aired nationally took a bold step. It was called Twelfth Night or Whatever, or Da Plays Da Ting, and featured a school production of Shakespeare presented entirely in Pidgin. That episode was shown only in Hawaii and has become famous since then as a lost episode of The Birds of Paradise.
And that was the answer to today's question, and Dean Calistro of Honolulu knew it. Thank you so much for playing our backyard quiz. And while we're doing thank yous, I want to remind you that more and more station members are choosing continuous monthly giving as their preferred way to financially support Hawaii Public Radio and its work. Mahalo to Dr. Michael Masters of Honolulu, Christiane Santoro of Makawao, and Annette Green of Hilo for their sustaining memberships. Sustaining membership is steadily lowering the amount of day-to-day operating support needed to be raised over the air. To become a sustaining member at the $10 a month level, call us at 955-8821 during business hours or go to hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks.
The title of the recording, Aloha, should give you all the hint you need. For decades, it was singers Danny Kalikini's signature greeting. Danny retired more than 20 years ago, but the music has never left him, and now his grandson, Nicholas, has become a keeper of the flame. Aloha is their first collaboration. It's a reworking of Hawaiian songs with a modern perspective, and both Nick and his grandpa, Danny, are in our studio to tell us about it. Good morning to both of you.
Aloha. Aloha kakahiaka na ohana ke ia e mai mai e kuma mai. Na te atu ho pō mai tai a oe. Aloha ke a kua. God is love. Aloha.
I was hoping you were going to say that, Danny. It was sort of makes the whole thing complete, doesn't it?
No, thank you for having us. God bless. Thank you.
I'll keep it simple. Good morning. And
good morning, Nick. Good to have you both in the studio. You know, I was thinking about the differences between the ways you got your music to the public, Danny, and the way you, Nick, are doing it now, because this new album has things like, you know, you can go online and download it with a special code and all that. And you in your day went down to Waikiki with just stood on the street and sang songs.
Right on the sidewalk with my ukulele. And
said, come to hear me at the Kahala.
Oh, yeah. It was, you know, it's just, we have a wonderful, beautiful Hawaiian show. Come join us.
Yeah.
I'd go down there, sing on the sidewalk and, you know, have my hula girl. And because nobody would come to the Kahala. We were too far away from Waikiki. And that's how we, you know, would go down every morning and stay, you know, slowly but surely they came. But the local people, they came and they supported. And when the local people came, then the Malahinis, the newcomers, they all came to the show.
And the rest is history, right, Danny?
Yeah, with 30 years, you know.
But, you know, Nick, for you, you had a whole different canvas to paint with, right? When you come to make a recording, you got a whole different way of getting it to the public.
Definitely. And I mean, you know, with technology now, it allows for independent artists to really take on that role. So it not only gives you, you know, creative freedom, but you can do things like distribution and publishing on your own.
Yeah.
And you can do it on your own time. We have a recording studio, so we're able, you know, to work on our own time, and, you know, there's no stress of getting things out, you know, on a certain time period. And, you know, working with my grandfather is amazing, you know. We're obviously family, but we get to work in this creative stage that kind of meshes, you know, different perspectives. And, of course, you know, I've learned so much from him. And, you know, at the end of the day, you still have to go out there and play for people. You know, it is kind of a hustle no matter what.
Sure.
And I think that's going to cross generations.
You still got to bring it when you're by yourself on stage,
definitely,
right?
Definitely.
Danny, when you first realized you had yourself a talented grandson, what kind of things did you tell him?
Well, I told him, I said, most important, aloha kia kua, God is love. And I said, you know, just thank him for the breath of life every day when you get up in the morning. And I said, you know, we all have our own talents, and that, you know, put it to full use, and but learn from your kupunas, learn from, you know, from your tutukani, your grandfather, tutuwahini, grandmother,
yeah.
And you know, what they share with you, you know, comes from the pu'uai, from the heart. And I said, you know, I was very fortunate that I learned from all my kupunas. I mean, you know, my grandfather taught me to sing the old Hawaiian songs. And, you know, my father was, he worked for the city and county. He was a refuge department. And my father sang some of the songs, but he wasn't the greatest singer. But I learned the words from him, and then all from the ohana. But everything was family style. I remember Fridays when everybody pauhana, pau work, they come home. And, you know, I live in Papakula, Hawaiian homestead. Everybody come in the backyard, you know, bring the six pack and the, you know, whatever pupus we had, and go in the backyard, bring out the ukulele, guitar, kanaka pila, himene na melehoa, and you sing all the songs. And that's how we learned to sing all the old songs.
Nick, did you have your generation's version of kanaka pila growing up?
No, and I mean, that's kind of the problem, I think, with my generation is, you know, we're isolated to our computers. We can learn just by ourselves on YouTube. But there's a major difference when you get to learn from, you know, a peer or a friend you're physically with. So I run a school of music called Powwow School of Music, and that's the idea to kind of create this third party, you know, education where, you know, the young generation can come together, because it's so important to learn music, you know, with and from each other.
Because something was lost when what Danny had growing up sort of died down.
Yeah, of course.
Don't you think?
You know, definitely. And, you know, another point is it's very important to learn from those, I don't like to say older than you are, but wiser, I think, more experience.
Which doesn't necessarily mean
older.
Yeah,
of course, definitely.
Right. Right.
And that's so important, you know, because they have so much to say. And like he said, you know, it's genuine. It truly is from the heart. And if you can understand that and take that in, it'll, you know, help you pursue, you know, maybe happiness or whatever you're envisioning, you know, life is about.
Well, Danny, that seems to me to be the thing that connects any type of music that's good. And, you know, remember Duke Ellington said there are two kinds of music, good and bad, right? And the good music, as you said, it has that heart connection. I think that's kind of the key ingredient, don't you?
Oh, yeah, the pu'uai, the heart. And I've always felt that, you know, whenever I sang a song, and I wanted to make sure I know what the meaning was, you know, the true meaning, and share this with everyone else.
Yeah.
And especially if you have, you know, I was very fortunate that I learned from my kupunas, my grandparents, you know, the songs of yesteryear, and then the songs of today, you know, you learn from your family and your friends, and then, you know, you get together, kanaka pila, and we get together Hawaiian style, everybody bring the ukulele and sing your song, and say, hey, that's a nice song, or, you know, how the words, you got the words, yeah, I want to learn that song.
Uh-huh.
You know? That was part of, you know, learning and education, you know. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's hope that tradition continues to thrive, because, you know, here you are two generations apart, but it's alive in both of you. It's good to see.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it's important that we share this with the young people, because they're the future of tomorrow. And, just to share with them the songs of yesteryear, and then to keep it alive, and the songs that you learned today.
Mm-hmm. Well, if anybody can do it, you guys can. Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for coming in.
Of course. Thank you, Chris. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Nicholas Kalaikini and his grandfather Danny have just released an extended play recording called Aloha. Nick plays saxophone, clarinet, and piano, and his grandfather, as if you didn't know, sings. You can find out more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
This week on Bridging the Gap, I'm breaking out the vinyl for a little fun on the turntables. We'll hear some contemporary cumbia from San Francisco's Disco Mas record label, as well as new cuts from the Bacow Rhythm and Steel Band. I'm Mr. Nick. Join me this Saturday evening from 6 to 8 p.m. for Bridging the Gap, here on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Beth Ann, just to hear Danny say aloha made my day for me.
And after having Danny and Nick in the studio this morning, not much more we need to say about that. I think they've said all that needs to be said.
Very nice little moment talking about how music comes right from the heart. That's a good lesson any day.
And how lucky they are to be able to share that.
That's right.
That's going to do it for us on this Wednesday. We'll be back tomorrow. We're going to talk with Representative Carl Rhodes about a bill prohibiting a person on the federal terrorist screening database from owning, possessing, or controlling a firearm.
And we'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at 808-792-8217. If you'd like to email us, that's talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation.
If you missed any of the show, or if you'd like to have a past one or any part of it, you can find all of it on the HPR2 archive. Links to information about guests and topics are there, too. Just look under Talk Shows for the conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
I'm Chris Vandergood.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning for more of the conversation.